Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. While doing research for today's show, I came across some reader responses to a New York Times series called Mother's Mind. One response jumped out at me, so I'd like to share that to start the show. It went, "Bravo! Your articles about postpartum depression are a comprehensive, accurate account of the various ways that perinatal illness can present. Postpartum depression often manifests with acute and high levels of anxiety. Anxiety can take many forms, and for the majority of postpartum women, it appears as negative, intrusive, scary thoughts about harming or even killing their babies. This phenomenon is extremely common. One researcher found that a whopping 91% of all new mothers, not restricted to women just with depression, experience these unwanted thoughts. Furthermore, 88% of new fathers experience similarly negative thoughts. When we talk about scary thoughts, we are sometimes talking about horrific, gruesome, shocking thoughts. These are not easy to shake off, and women fear that the worse the thoughts are, the sicker they must be. This part is not true. When women feel safe enough to disclose these thoughts and don't feel judged, they often experience immediate relief, even if the thoughts persist." Imagine my surprise when I saw that this had been written by today's guest, Karen Kleiman. It's a nice way to move into that. Karen Kleiman returns to Line One for an encore appearance. She led off our show on maternal mental health in June, but only had a short time to spend with us, so it's a pleasure to get the opportunity to spend a full hour with her today, looking deeper into the issue of postpartum distress. For those who did not catch the show in June, let me take a minute to introduce my guests. Karen Kleiman is a licensed clinical social worker, well-known as an international expert on postpartum depression. Karen is the founder and director of the Postpartum Stress Center in Pennsylvania, and more recently founded the Postpartum Stress and Family Wellness Center in New Jersey. Karen's national television appearances include The Katie Couric Show, Inside Edition, The Oprah Winfrey Show, and NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw. Some of her magazine credits include Fit Pregnancy, Parenting, Working Mother, Star, and Mothering Magazine. Karen is featured as an expert on PsychologyToday.com as a best voice in psychology, as the author of her blog, This Isn't What I Expected, Notes on Healing Postpartum Depression. Karen has authored or co-authored a number of books on the subject of postpartum mental health and gives frequent lectures on the subject. Welcome to the show, Karen. Thanks for coming back to join us.
Thank you, Francis. I'm so thrilled to be here again, really.
Well, we had such a good time, and it just seemed like we just got to brush over the top of some of these things with you, and I really am happy that we get a chance to dig a little bit deeper into this stuff now, so appreciate it.
I'm so happy that you want to do this, that you're interested in this, because as we've talked before, you know, it's something that we need to keep the dialogue going with, and a lot of people are too afraid to talk about it, so bravo to you, too.
There doesn't seem to be anything more important in my mind than the wellness of children, infants, and mothers. So, so I appreciate you coming, and it's a good thing to talk about. I want to take a minute to update our listeners on a battle I am engaged in. If you missed my last show, it was on nicotine addiction. During that show, I discussed my own struggles with nicotine addiction in the form of smokeless tobacco, and I made a statement of intent to quit using smokeless tobacco on the 23rd of July of this year, after 34 years of use. Happy to report, I have not used any tobacco products and have been free of nicotine since that date. I will say it's been fairly unpleasant experience, but one that seems to be getting easier every day and was well worth the effort. So for those of you who are thinking about quitting, either smoking or chewing, my advice is do it soon. If you're trying now, one thing that really helped me, I found, was writing about the experience each day. Writing my feelings and thoughts down seemed to kind of help me maintain my motivation and keep my goals in the front of my brain. I chose to use a blog format, so I just opened a blog on blogspot.com, super easy. But old-fashioned journaling will work just as well. Just be sure to share it with somebody, so have an accountability partner. Okay, now back to our regular scheduled program. I want to remind listeners that Line 1 is a live call-in show and that your calls always enrich the program. Your message or story might be the thing that gives someone hope or inspiration. We can be reached with your questions or comments in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call us toll-free If you're out of the Anchorage area or out of the state, at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate in the show is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, Karen, we're going to focus our attention today on two areas of interest: scary thoughts and the impacts of postpartum distress on the intimate partner relationship. So if I could just get you to start us off with postpartum depression seems to be what most people have heard of, but it's a lot deeper than that. So could you talk a little bit why you chose the term, or maybe you didn't choose it, postpartum distress?
Sure. Can I start first by segueing from your nicotine piece, which good for you.
Absolutely.
I know that's really hard. It's interesting also that you found that journaling is most successful for you, because that's actually something that we talk a lot about in terms of coping with distress and scary thoughts too. So it has been shown, you know, evidence-based, that it really can help the brain by focusing on the positive and what you're doing that's good for you, and helping your brain stay away from some of the negative influences. So it's good. It's great that you're still doing it. 34 years.
34 years. I started when I was like 13, I think.
Yeah.
So that dates me.
Yeah,
but
good for you. Okay, so postpartum distress is a fairly new term. You're absolutely right. We've talked about postpartum depression for a while, and what we found was that those of us who work in this area, we know that postpartum depression is by definition a very agitated depression, so it's often accompanied by a lot of anxiety. And what was happening is in the rest of the world, if you're not studying it or treating it, you may not understand that, because you hear postpartum depression and you sort of get these images of, you know, mom sitting in a dark room under her covers, not eating and not being with the baby and being dark and depressed. But what we actually see is an enormous amount of anxiety with women when they have, sometimes with depression and sometimes without depression. Sometimes it's just anxiety. And so we coined the term postpartum distress to encompass both, to encompass feelings of depression and anxiety. Sometimes there's just one, sometimes there's both. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. They seem to, I mean, without postpartum, you know, if you drop the postpartum part, anxiety and depression often feed each other. Just typically. So postpartum distress, you're saying depression often manifests as anxiety and agitation?
Postpartum depression can manifest as either. It can be just depression, it can be just anxiety, or it can be depression and anxiety.
Okay.
Okay. So, and the definition is really based on what the predominant symptom is. So, if somebody has, you know, mostly symptoms of panic or mostly symptoms of OCD, then often her diagnosis may be postpartum OCD. But postpartum depression is an umbrella term that we've all sort of gotten used to, but it includes all of those. It includes postpartum anxiety, postpartum panic, postpartum OCD, postpartum PTSD.
Okay, so all of those things are sort of under that umbrella, but it really is much more complicated than just depression and the image of, as you said, somebody in bed unable to go pick up her baby and feed it.
Right, right. And we just felt that the term postpartum depression and postpartum distress, like I said, encompasses both. So it includes women with anxiety, quite frankly, were feeling sort of left out of the loop because they were feeling so sick and so symptomatic and weren't being taken care of by their doctors in the same way, because they weren't having symptoms of depression, but instead they were walking around having all of these symptoms of, you know, feeling dissociating, feeling like that they couldn't take care of the baby, having these scary thoughts, but they didn't feel particularly depressed. So they really thought they were going crazy. They really didn't know what was going on because they weren't identifying with the symptoms that they were hearing about in terms of depression.
Okay, so how good are people getting, healthcare providers, professionals, at identifying this? And has our awareness increased over the years? Or 'cause it's not talked about. I mentioned this last time in my practice. I've become a lot more aware of it since my last show on it. But it seems like a lot of women go undiagnosed. Is there a particular reason for that? Or
that's such a good question. I wish I had a good answer. I have to tell you, it is my greatest frustration really. It is my greatest frustration. I've been doing this for so long and doing a lot of outreach in that area and training and teaching for healthcare providers. And there are a lot of reasons why it's still, you know, sort of under the radar. And some of the reasons are that quite honestly, healthcare providers don't always, they either don't have the right education about it specifically, or some of them are afraid to go in there. You know, if I start asking a mom about mental health issues, I'm not a psychiatrist. This is beyond my scope of practice. I'm afraid to open that Pandora's box. And it also goes both ways. Moms are sort of 50% responsible. You know, are providers asking the right questions, we say? And then we say, if they do, are moms disclosing? Are moms talking about how they feel? And there are so many variables here, Prentice. There are so many variables in terms of what gets in the way. The biggest would be stigma. You know, that would be the biggest overall barrier, would be that there's still so much shame and misinformation around mental health and motherhood. You know, I mean, think about it. The broader issue is stigma is attached to mental illness in general. That's pervasive. And then when we talk about postpartum depression, when we talk about a depressive episode during the postpartum period, it's sort of like this sacred life event that is surrounded with all kinds of expectations of joy. And so I don't want to tell you that I'm feeling terrible about being a mother because I'm afraid you're going to judge me, or I'm afraid you're going to think I'm a bad mother, or I'm afraid you're going to, worse, take my baby away. I mean, that's the worst fear every mother has. So we live in a culture that doesn't make it easy to talk out loud about how bad you feel.
Yeah.
Back to your first question about why healthcare providers aren't talking about it either, or aren't asking the right questions. Some of them are, and they are getting better. But to be honest with you, I think part of that is just they're afraid of the worst case scenarios that we hear, you know, splashed across the headlines. So they're afraid of that. We're still missing the majority of women who look really good and don't look like they're sick, don't act like they're sick, and they're sort of, you know, they're excellent at maintaining this pretense that everything's okay.
Now, the worst case scenario thing you're talking about, is that like postpartum psychosis, when you hear about, I guess there was a psychiatrist in Toronto that jumped in front of a train with her baby 10 years ago or so. That's the kind of thing you're talking about?
That would be a worst-case scenario, right. So that's, you know, statistics say that people quote statistics as this being rare. The statistic is 1 in about 1,000 births. So it's rare, but it's, you know, it's not rare if you're part of that family. So it's scary to those of us who work in this field. And it's scary to OBs and pediatricians who look out for it, quite honestly, because that's all we really hear about. Media jumps on that stuff. You know, and so when something catastrophic happens, we're all reading about it, we're all talking about it, but then they're talking about it as postpartum depression for a very long time. They've been miscalling it, they've been mislabeling it as postpartum depression, which actually keeps moms further inside in silence, because now, you know, if I say I feel bad about being a mother, somebody's going to think I'm psychotic. So definitions have been blurred. And it makes it a little bit more complicated.
It's important that we use the correct language then, because, yes, postpartum psychosis is what everybody fears about. But in my reading, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that postpartum depression isn't necessarily associated with postpartum psychosis. I mean, just because you're depressed, I mean, your odds aren't increased.
Correct. Postpartum depression does not lead to postpartum psychosis. They are two distinct entities. There can be, you know, when we're talking about postpartum depression, there could be mild and moderate and very severe postpartum depression. But that's still different from postpartum psychosis.
Okay, so it's important not to get those things confused, because, as you said, that leads to the stigma. You mentioned something. Let me remind folks who might be tuning in late that my guest today is licensed clinical social worker and founder of the Postpartum Stress Center in Pennsylvania, Karen Kleiman. Karen is a tested expert in the field of postpartum depression and an accomplished author on the subject. Remind folks that you can reach us with your questions or comments for Karen in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. That leads really well into starting to talk about scary thoughts, because I would think that the concept of scary thoughts and some of the thoughts that people have are very similar to the things that people do when they're psychotic. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I do know what you mean. And that's precisely why most women are afraid to talk about how they're feeling, because many women have scary thoughts after they have a baby. Many dads have scary thoughts after they have a baby. We're just sort of focusing on moms, but both moms and dads have scary thoughts. And it's so common, it is so common, that we consider it to be a universal phenomenon. And I'm talking about really scary thoughts. The research shows, if we can just throw out some statistics, that 91% of all new mothers, this is not just moms who have postpartum depression, but all new mothers report having these negative, scary, intrusive thoughts after about harm coming to their baby. 88% of all new fathers report this. So it's really common, and we sort of describe them as, uh-oh, you know, what if I drop the baby? What if I burn the baby in the bathtub? What if when I'm walking, he just slips out of my hand? What if, you know, and that's on one end of it. That's sort of the lower end of the scary thoughts.
That's sort of the normal, everyday, like, is the baby awake or breathing in the crib? Just normal things that are heightened awareness that parents have.
That is true, but the point we want to emphasize here is that on the continuum of scary, there can be scarier thoughts that are just as normal, and that's the take-home point, that the scarier they are, we think that the scarier they feel or sound, the less normal they are, okay? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so what you're saying is that if I imagine that every time I pick up and walk down the stairs, I'm going to trip, that's extra caution, and that I'm really scared that I'm going to fall and hurt my baby. That's one thing, but there's a different level of scary thoughts, which is what? What's the next level?
Well, the next level would be, what if I throw the baby down the steps? Okay.
Right.
What if I what if I actually have an urge to do something that's gonna have a terrible outcome, and I did it on purpose. It can have intent. So then further along scary, then it can get even scarier, like violent, like graphic, like horrific. Like every time I walk by the knives in the kitchen, I picture myself. I can imagine myself picking up that knife. Why would I do that? I love my baby. Oh my God. Why? I must be going mad.
Right, and you certainly wouldn't tell anybody about that.
Right? And some women don't even tell their husbands. Or
right.
Some women don't even tell their mothers or their best friend because, oh my God, they'll take my baby away. And our point is the nature of the thought, the content of the thought, is not clinically relevant to us, to those of us who know the difference. What we worry about when we worry about scary thoughts is really two things. We worry about her level of distress and how much it interferes with her ability to function, not what she's thinking about.
Okay, so it's more about how much it bothers her.
Exactly. And everybody has varying degrees of tolerance. So it's, you know, what bothers me might not bother you. What brings me to a psychologist might be something that you do every single day. Know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, certain people have different levels of tolerance.
Right.
So what drove you to write the book, Dropping the Baby and Other Scary Thoughts?
Well, what we're talking about really drove me to write the book, because moms didn't understand that it's okay and it's normal. I mean, we spend pages and pages giving examples of scary thoughts, which, by the way, FYI, this can be agitating for women to read.
Yeah.
It can be agitating for women to read what other scary thoughts people are having. So there can be triggers when you read about this. But we did want to normalize it. We wanted to put it out there that it's normal to have thoughts of, you know, picturing myself driving off the road with my baby in the car. it doesn't mean it's okay, meaning, it, of course, it feels terrible. And by the way, the fact that it feels terrible, the fact that moms are distressed by this, is precisely what tells us she's not psychotic. Because right. she should be nervous about that. Of course, anybody would be nervous if they're, you know, if they're having thoughts of harm coming to their baby. And her anxiety, you know, those feelings of nervousness is what tells us diagnostically that these are anxiety-driven and not psychotically driven.
So if
we wanted, to normalize this for moms,
right? And if 91% of mothers experience scary thoughts, and a large portion, and fathers 88%, and if a large portion experience these sort of really disturbing scary thoughts, it almost seems like it's normal, and there must be a reason behind it. And that's something that just popped into my head. Is it? I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, is it heightened awareness by a parent for dangers, or?
Well, sure. I mean, when you think about it, you know, anxiety has been adaptive for a long time, you know, historically speaking, and a little bit of anxiety is good. I know that personally, don't you?
Yeah, it's activating.
Right? It sends off an alert, you know, button, and we just go and we take care and we protect and we help our babies thrive, and we do all kinds of wonderful things. It's really the level of anxiety that becomes problematic. And once anxiety sets in, once it's, you know, pervasive, it feeds itself. Anxiety is very anxiety-producing, right? It makes us anxious to feel so anxious, and it feeds on itself.
We become fearful of the fear itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so whose job is it to have this discussion with women? And where should it start about these scary thoughts? I mean, should everybody just get a copy of all of your books in the box set, like at the beginning when they have a baby, like so they can learn everything
Don't
they need
think?
To know about postpartum depression
yeah.
and distress? Yeah.
Yeah. I've been saying that for 30 years. So whose job is it? That's a very good question. And you know, one of the great things that's happening now because of the internet is that moms are talking, and there's just way more attention. National conversation has started, and so, in spite of the shame and stigma, moms are coming out and saying, "Look what horrible experience I've had, and I want to talk about it, and I want to help women." And so, healthcare providers are starting to listen, and so it's both. Again, as we said before, it's the doctor's, it's the healthcare provider's job to ask the right questions. The right question to me means, are you asking every single pregnant and postpartum woman if they're having thoughts that are scaring them? And that's the question that we ask. Are you having any thoughts that are scaring you? And that can be two thoughts. I mean, it can be either about harm coming to my baby, or it can be thoughts of hurting myself, which is, quite frankly, much more problematic. Because women with postpartum depression actually do not hurt their babies. They are afraid they're going to hurt their babies. Women with postpartum depression go to extreme lengths to protect their babies, and they are far more at risk to hurt themselves in order to protect their babies. So we worry about women committing suicide when they're depressed and anxious, but not hurting their babies, even though that's what they fear the most.
Okay, so what we're actually concentrating on and what the media concentrates on as far as the sensationalism of postpartum depression is not what we really need to be worried about. What we really need to be worried about is the mother.
Right. We need to get this information out so mom understands that these scary thoughts are just that, scary thoughts, and although they feel terrible, no harm will, you know, they are not correlated with harm action being taken. But action is taken when moms want to hurt themselves. And yes, we need to protect her from that.
Yeah, that is obviously the ultimate thing is mom hurting herself, and then the whole family is impacted. Okay, so
yeah, let me. Can I add something to that, Press?
Please. Okay.
The thing about postpartum depression that makes it so complex, and one of the things that I always want to tell moms is that the symptoms feel like who she is. You know, it feels like I'm a bad mother and I, you know, I've lost control and I can't do this right and I shouldn't have had a baby. But one of the first interventions is to tell mom that these are symptoms, even though they feel like who she is. These are symptoms. And when we treat this, you will no longer feel this way. You will no longer think this way. But she doesn't know how to tease that out. She doesn't know the difference between her symptoms and who she is. And that's why she's at such risk for hurting herself. My baby will be better off if I'm not here.
Okay, it goes into that self-loathing and that shameful place for a lot of women.
Right.
All right, you said in your response to the New York Times article, you mentioned that women get almost immediate relief from scary thoughts once they have, like, spoken them out loud and realized that they are not alone. What are some of the things that, I mean, have you, like, witnessed that or seen that, like, that wave of relief?
I do want to clarify just that that's only true if she's expressing them in a safe place where she feels unjudged and where she feels cared for. You know, if she says this at a place where she's feeling under duress or she's being asked by somebody that she doesn't think cares or she's not trusting that they're going to do the right thing with this information, clearly it's going to increase her agitation. But if she feels like she's in the right place, whether it's the right healthcare provider or her partner or some place where she feels that she's going to be loved unconditionally or taken care of, taken to the right place, absolutely, I have seen a woman's anxiety go from 10 to a 3 because I'm not going crazy. You know, there is treatment. There is hope for me. This is normal or it's okay or I'm in the right place to go forward and be all right and I'm not going crazy. And so, and this is a woman's greatest fear, and that's why we're talking about it, so that she knows where to go and what to do.
I was talking to a woman once who had a baby, and she was talking about her lack of, like, attachment and just not liking the baby and thinking about bad things for the baby. And like, when I said to her, well, that's really normal. A lot of people have those sorts of thoughts. And I normalized it. She sat back. I saw her whole body, like, relax and sit back, and like this wave of relief just kind of washed over her. It was remarkable.
Yeah, we used to call that the Gerber baby syndrome, you know, where we have these expectations, whether it's coming from media, whether it's coming from, you know, TV or our friends or our neighbors, you know, and you look on the playground and all these new moms, you know, they're 3 weeks postpartum and they're in spandex with lipstick on and their hair's cute and they're just, and you're sitting here like, I am the only person who has ever felt so inadequate and hopeless and empty, and I suck at this. And I don't want to be a mother, and I'm never going to look that good. And right, so our society reinforces both positively and negatively. You know, first they're showing us all the fancy people who lose all their weight and look gorgeous after they have a baby, and then they're showing us about women who want to kill their babies, and they're calling it postpartum depression. So the masses of women are seeing all of this being splashed all over the place, and they don't know where to go to tell somebody how they're honestly feeling.
Nothing. I think I just lost my... Did we square it away? Okay. I'm not sure what's going on with our mic, but I think actually this might be a good time to take a break. So let me remind folks that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Our topic today is postpartum distress. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion with Karen Kleiman. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection from KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is international expert on postpartum distress, Karen Kleiman. We had a really good discussion about scary thoughts during the first half of the show. So if you missed it, I would encourage you to tune in tonight at 9 or podcast the show to hear that portion of today's conversation with Karen. I want to remind listeners that Dr. Woodard will continue to bring you the latest health information on Line 1 three Mondays each month, and I'll continue to host a monthly show dedicated to mental and emotional health. I also want to remind listeners that you can podcast today's show and access the library of every Line 1 show that Dr. Woodard or I have done by visiting our website, alaskapublic.org, and clicking on the link to Line 1. Remember, you can email questions or comments about today's topic to line1@alaskapublic.org or call locally with your questions or comments at 550-8433 or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a tape recording and we will not be accepting phone calls. Okay, so we're back. Before the break, we were talking about scary thoughts, and one of the things, I guess I just want to, before we move on to a discussion about the intimate relationship and another one of your books, I'd like for you to kind of leave folks with something that you want them to remember, a take-home point for scary thoughts. What's one thing?
Sure. Well, first of all, there is no correlation between a mom's scary thoughts and her taking any action in response to these thoughts. And I think that's important in terms of her being reassured by that. And she should remember that her anxiety is a natural response to this time in her life. And if there's anything about it that's scaring her, she does, you know, she will feel better if she talks about it with somebody that helps her feel safe and cared for.
One of the most interesting things that I read was that one of the problems with identifying postpartum depression and postpartum anxiety is that the women who go into their doctor, they may not have taken a shower in days and they're not sleeping, but to go to the doctor, to go out, they dress up, put on their makeup, their best face, and they go and they say, "It's great being a mom." So doctors miss it.
I can't tell you how often, and to this day, you know, we see women coming into our waiting room looking like, we always, you know, joke about it, they look better than we do on our best days. You know, they spend a lot of time, you know, making sure they look good. What's true about that is that it's an area of control for postpartum women who are feeling that, you know, everything is so out of control right now. And, you know, literally, like you said, they haven't slept slept well in nights, and they haven't showered, and they're not able to eat well, and they're preoccupied with the baby. And so they're out of control. And if they, you know, when they go step outside, they don't want anybody seeing that. And so they spend a lot of time reconciling this, so to speak, by making sure they get themselves together and looking good. And so they do. They walk in the door. They look really good. And unless you know to ask those questions, this does not look like somebody that you want to ask. Do you have weapons in your house?
Right.
Are you having thoughts of killing yourself? Are you having thoughts of hurting your baby? You're almost embarrassed, you know? Are you self-medicating with alcohol? Are you doing any drugs?
Right.
These don't look like women who are going to be doing that. And some of them are.
Yeah, it's important not to just blow over it and glass over it because things look right or look good on the surface.
Right, and when we're doing trainings, we say to healthcare providers and therapists alike, we say, you know, if you aren't asking every single woman who walks in your door whether she's having thoughts of hurting herself or not, you have no idea whether she's suicidal. No idea. Because the way she looks, the way she sounds, the way she's behaving is fooling you, it's fooling everybody else, and this mom that looks so good is going home and thinking about ways that she can kill herself. And we have to sleep at night, so, you know, ask those hard questions. And still it doesn't mean she's going to tell you.
Right.
But if you ask it in the right way to help her feel cared for, she will.
They certainly might be more willing. So when... Real briefly, I think you kind of answered this, but I wanted you to to answer it again because I think it's important. When should someone, a woman, or like if you have a family member you're concerned about, when should somebody seek out professional help, talk to their healthcare provider, or find a therapist who specializes in postpartum?
Well, I always trust a woman the way, you know, to she's the best predictor of where she's going with this, and if she's worried about the way she's feeling, then I trust that. And that doesn't mean that anything terrible is happening, but if she doesn't like the way she's feeling, she needs to let somebody know that. And maybe she just needs some reassurance from somebody who knows. But it's not okay for her to walk around feeling bad. So she shouldn't wait until there's a panic attack or, you know, some symptom that is so severe that she can't function anymore. She should start as soon as she doesn't like the way she's feeling and let somebody know.
Yeah, what you said, you said it really well. You said that it depends on her level of distress from the thoughts. Because somebody might have really scary thoughts, then they're like, I know what those are. Right.
That's exactly right. Like every time my children drive in the snow, I always say every single time, you know, they're going to one's 30 and one's going to be, you know, and one's 27 and they get in the car and it's snowing or it's raining. And I think, oh, my God. And for about for a split second, I can picture the car going off the cliff. Right. And then I say to my brain, OK, that's OK. Go do something else. And it's gone. So the thought is scary, but my level of distress associated with it is not. Because I'm able to move it out of my brain. But if I started obsessing about it, if I started thinking about it, if I started talking to my husband about it, if I stayed up all night waiting, if I texted them every 5 minutes, then it's interfering. Then I can't get to work. Then I'm not functioning well. So that's one of the barometers of, you know, when there's trouble or not. It's only problematic. The frequency, intensity, and duration equals level of distress. So,
all right.
My level of distress is high, and it interferes with functioning.
Okay, good. So if you're just tuning in, my guest is Karen Kleiman, and we're discussing postpartum distress. You can reach us with your question or comments in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org, and you got to spell all that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. If you have some questions or comments for Karen, get them in now because we're going to be running out of time. So go ahead and don't be afraid to call in. Okay, let's move on to the next topic, which is the topic of tokens and your book, Tokens of Affection. So can you speak to me a little bit about why you wrote that book?
Sure. Sitting with couples who have been through, you know, the drama and the pain of depression and the joy of having a new baby, they come out of it, you know, many of them come out of it stronger than before, but a fair number come out just weary as anything, and frankly not very nice to each other. And so what happened, after couple, I'm watching, and I didn't like the way they were talking to each other. I didn't like the way they were feeling about their partners. I didn't like the way they didn't like the way their marriage felt. And I realized that there was a strong relationship between the depression and the connection, the depression and the marital connection. And so I was in search of a kinder, gentler relationship and wanted to help them find that again. And I discovered that actually most of them want that. Most of them want that, you know, tools to get back together because I miss you and I need you and I want you back, but I'm so tired and resentful and angry that I don't know how to do it.
All right, we're going to jump right back on that, but we have a phone call. Natasha, you're on the air with Karen Kleiman.
Hi, I wanted to make a comment about doctors picking up on the symptoms of postpartum distress. I know that I didn't go to the doctor very much after I had my baby because I was relatively healthy. And it would have been probably more helpful if the pediatrician had asked me some questions because I went to see the pediatrician far more often.
Natasha, that is a wonderful point, and I'm glad you brought it up. And in fact, pediatricians are getting way on board right now. You know, it's taken a while. It moved from OBs, you know, who basically said after your 6-week checkup we're done, so to speak. And pediatricians are present as you and the baby continue to develop through this. And you're right, they are right in place. They have a lot invested in making sure mom's okay so that she can take care of their patient. And you're right about that. And they are learning, and they are starting to ask the hard questions, and they're doing a lot of screening for postpartum depression and anxiety.
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Natasha.
Yes, I appreciate that.
That's a really good point, and one that I think we touched on in our last show, is that we have a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of opportunities for professionals and caregivers to meet with mothers right after the baby is born from a variety of different angles. And maybe the problem is that everybody else thinks the other one's supposed to be doing it. But pediatricians,
well, that's right. And, you know, there's just some research out that did point out that moms are actually depressed for a lot longer than we think, and that just screening them immediately postpartum isn't enough, and that we need to ask these questions for a long time. I think the study said up to 4 years or something.
Wow.
Awful scary like that. Yeah.
All right. So it doesn't, when you have a 1-year-old, you're not out of the woods necessarily.
Sort of. Yeah. That's another show.
Postpartum depression for later. Like, mm-hmm. So up to 4 years old, we should be concerned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're not always, you know, we technically just call it postpartum depression within the first year. And sometimes some of us extend it beyond that because of the extra demands of new motherhood. So within the first couple years, but this research is showing that moms are reporting symptoms of depression, you know, longer than that.
It's a giant adjustment disorder that keeps going and going and going, right? Having a baby.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I like that. A giant adjustment disorder. We're going to put that in the DSM-5.
That's right. It should be. Mm-hmm. So I want to I want to read something that you wrote in Tokens that I really liked. When we're talking about your marriage, believe it or not, what matters most is how you feel about the way your behavior, words, body language, and actions make your partner feel. Let's repeat that. What really matters, what is most fundamental to the well-being of your marriage, is how much you care about what your partner is feeling. That sort of sums up beautifully what I try to explain to couples all the time. But how do people get there and hold that position when they're struggling, as you mentioned, with tired and resentful and feel like nobody's, you know, is doing what they're supposed to be doing and you got everything going on? So how do you get to that place?
Right. Well, how do you think? You read the book and you do the tokens, right? It's really, you know, the truth is anger and resentment, you know, those are big, bad emotions, but they are not they are not incompatible with doing this work in terms of rebuilding the connection. So you can be angry and you can have intense feelings and you can still get back together. It's hard to go, you know, we're talking about empathy here. We're talking about the ability to care about what somebody who you love, what your partner is feeling. It's really hard to do when you're angry, for sure, and when you're tired and when you're depleted emotionally and so forth. But that's sort of what this book was based on. Like, I know that's how you feel. And the worst part is, the really ironic part, and I don't know how far we can go into this, is that it's often the woman's job. She's often better at the relationship building piece. And if she's going to take this on, she has to take this on when she's emerging from a depression. And frankly, she's not in the mood to do that. You know, she's tired, and she's tired of being tired. And she just, the relationship does not always look like a good place to go for nourishment and fulfillment, but it's exactly where she needs to go.
Well, and she's got plenty to do and plenty to worry about besides having to worry about, like, her big man-child person that she's got to take care of his feelings.
You just got some extra credit from all the women listening right now. you're completely right about that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, really is true. When you're not sleeping and you're up, you know, new baby, and you've been depressed, and it really is quite a challenge to put it in your mind that you need to be concerned with your partner's feelings. And the same thing with dads. They're tired, too.
Of course they are. And the reason why it's important, and again, we're not talking about doing this 3 days postpartum or 4 weeks postpartum. We're talking about, you know, after, you know, so it can be at a later point. But we are talking about putting some time and energy into the relationship. Yeah, even when you're tired and you don't feel like doing it. You know, remember that the depression is also a very sort of, ego state of primary need satisfaction, you know what I mean? It's very self-absorbing to
right.
be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're asking you to turn towards your partner and to pay attention to the relationship, because the relationship is so important that it actually will help her feel better if we can take care of the relationship at some point, too. So it's hard to do it, but it's really, really important. What we say is that the relationship will thrive in direct proportion to the degree of attention you place on it. So if you put it aside and take care of the baby for too long, of course you do that to some extent. But if you do that too long, you know, that's when couples wake up one day and say, where are you? Where have you been? What do we need to do here? And that doesn't feel good.
So you're talking about nurturing that relationship a little bit, even though you got other things that are maybe a bigger priority? Or maybe it's the biggest priority.
You know what? It's bigger than it feels. It feels like the baby is the biggest priority. But you know, the research shows us that you know, the postpartum period is a time when there's really a lot of strain on the marriage. And that communication can break down, and ambivalence can set in, and really big bad things like disengagement can set in, and, you know, there's a lot at stake. So somehow we need to do all of it at the same time, just to add more to your plate, right?
Yeah, that's a tall order. So what are you seeing in your practice as far as couples coming in, and what are the problems or the I guess, consistent areas of concern that couples are coming to you with?
Usually it is communication. Usually they will say, you know, that they don't, precisely what you started with the whole empathy piece. You know, he doesn't care how I feel, and she doesn't care how I feel, and I'm tired. Well, I'm tired, and I'm angry. Well, I'm angry. And they sometimes just need a platform where they can just say what they need to say and feel heard. Nobody's taking care of each other. And one of the primary components of tokens, the foundation of this, of the tools that work, is that I will feel better if I take better care of you. You know, if we do this with too much sort of selfish, you know, gain here, then all I'm doing is taking from you. But if I give you something, then you're going to be in a better position to take care of me. And like you said, that's a tall order when, you know, if I'm tired and weary, but it actually pays off.
Yeah, if you can push through that resistance. But it is goes back to the old adage of helping somebody else is the thing that helps you the most.
That's right.
Okay, so can you explain real quick, like if somebody's worried about their marriage and they're going to go out and buy your book, like what can they expect? Like what are the tokens? It sounds like, I mean, it's actually a tool. So can you kind of explain for the readers what that means, tokens of affection?
Right. What it basically means is that there are 8 tokens that have research behind them that show that when couples give, you know, a token is an object of value. So tokens of affection represent principles that have been shown to be associated with an increase in marital satisfaction. So, for instance, the tokens are esteem, collaboration, compromise, selflessness, sanctuary, expression, tolerance, and loyalty. And so the book will help them help couples understand what that means and how to do it. What does collaborating mean in a marriage? What does compromise mean in a marriage? For instance, one of the tools that was very interesting to me when I was researching it was that there's research that shows that couples who use we and us language instead of I and me and you are you know, this is associated with greater long-term marital satisfaction. Interesting. So we need to, you know, when we envision us as a couple, as a unit, and say, where are we going tonight, instead of what do you want to do tonight?
Right.
There's actually an association with greater happiness, things like that. So how do we tweak things? How do I talk differently to you? How do I look at you differently? How do I, you know, appraise things differently? And each of these tools, at the end of each chapter, actually, there are specific tools. Try this, try this, try this.
So there's
and
exercises.
It's written for couples to really care. Yes, exercises on rebuilding the connection.
Is it fair to say it's like a workbook? You do, like, everybody has, like, homeworks, partners actively engaged with each other and trying to...
No, not fair to say that. No, no. No. I mean, I guess you could say it's a workbook, but there's no fill in the blank. So you know, yes, there are things that you can try. There are exercises at the end. There are what we call token tools at the end of each one. And then we say, you know, I'm trying to find you a good example, but I can't. For selflessness, token, you know, when in doubt, give first. Always, always be aware of how your partner is feeling. And then we give you an example of what to do and how to try it. Try this and try that. So.
Now, you mentioned
sort of simplify it because it's hard to do when you're feeling bad. Yes.
You mentioned that this is a book for couples who are really engaged in wanting to be well. There's some situations where this is not going to work, correct? I mean, what are the things that how do women who are in a position where the husband is not supportive and is angry at her for her scary thoughts, or like, how do you help women navigate that?
Well, you know, like, we help them navigate everything, you know, meaning we put it out there, we put words to it, we explain it, and we see, you know, we obviously want to bring both partners in when the marriage is fragile, and we want to really see, what are we seeing here? Is this sort of a reactive emotional state because you're hurt and you're in, you know, despairing? And that there's a core that we want to get you back to? Or was the marriage really struggling prior to this? Were you really in trouble long before you got sick? If it's, you know, that doesn't mean that depression cannot obliterate a marriage, because it can,
right?
Just the depression, even if it was strong beforehand. But that's less likely if a marriage was strong beforehand, it's more likely that we can help you if you get to the right place in time. Because, you know, it's hard. There are certain situations, you know, where depression is severe, or when we talk about things like, you know, bipolar disorder or anything like that, that makes things even, can make it even more, it can add another layer of complication on top of it. The truth is, it's hard for each partner, you know. It's hard to be sick, and it's hard to live with somebody who's sick. And support is so important, and good communication is so important. It's just, it's like it would be for any other medical condition. If someone had cancer, you know, you can't imagine how horrible it must be to have cancer, and you can't imagine how horrible it must be to live with somebody who has cancer. And still, you would understand both. You understand, you know, how scary it is from both sides. And that's partly what we want to do with a couple who's in the throes of, you know, depression fallout, is to validate that it's hard for everybody. It's as hard for him as it is for her, and so forth. And we want them to be at a level playing field, so we can sort of start over and get back to where we were when it felt good.
You mentioned cancer.
Not easy and not quickly. Yes.
You mentioned cancer, and it takes me all the way back to the beginning of the show when you talked about stigma and how important it's got to be for people to talk about this stuff, scary thoughts, postpartum depression, in the same way that they would talk about a tumor, or, you know, I'm having this weird lump in my throat, I better go see a doctor. If I have these scary thoughts about my baby, maybe I should go talk to somebody because they're bothering me.
Well, thank you for saying that, really, Prentice, because that's exactly what, you know, advocates have been saying for a long time. This is a medical condition.
Yes.
It is, you know, it is as real as any other medical condition, and we got to get the stigma out of there so we can talk about it without the shame and get the help that women need. And can I mention also that the support that's out there for women, Postpartum Support International, is at postpartum.net, is a wonderful place for women all across the world to get support. And postpartumprogress.com is also a wonderful place online for moms to get support. There's so much more advocacy right now that it's safer now than ever before for moms to talk about their scary thoughts and for couples to talk about how bad their marriage may feel in the interim until they start to pay attention to it and help her feel healthy and strong. And it can get much stronger than it ever was before.
So it sounds like we're turning a corner as far as making it more public awareness and acceptance, and it's getting more out into the mainstream.
We're turning a corner because of, you know, shows like yours and people like you who pay attention to it and believe in it and want to put it out there. So I can't thank you enough for doing that.
Okay. Is there anything? We are just out of time, running up against it. So is there anything you want to add or leave folks with before I take us out?
I want to, as far as the marriage, I guess one of my sound bites would be if you want to accomplish something in your marriage, you first have to expect it from yourself. And so, you know, that goes back to the empathy piece that you talked about. And I really think it's important for women and men alike to sort of take ownership of what you need to do, take care of your partner, and your marriage will thrive and you'll both benefit from that. And then just to go back to the beginning, postpartum distress. You've done such a great job bringing this out in the forefront again, Prentice, and I just want to say, talk about your postpartum depression and anxiety. Talk about it. Tell somebody.
Well, Karen, it has been a delight. I really feel fortunate that you came back to join us, and I appreciate your time, and maybe I'll tap you in the future again at some point.
You do know where to find me. Thanks for having me.
Okay, my thanks to today's guest, Karen Kleiman, for taking the time to join us from Pennsylvania for today's show. If you would like to continue today's conversation, join KSK on Facebook. You can find the link on our website at alaskapublic.org. And you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. Please, if you or someone you love are experiencing any of the challenges we discussed on today's show, talk to your healthcare provider or get a referral for a counselor who specializes in postpartum distress. Postpartum depression and anxiety can be debilitating disorders that are difficult to deal with alone. The good news is that they are very treatable if addressed early. Perhaps the best approach to dealing with postpartum distress is to anticipate it and be prepared for it. After all, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of medicine. On the next Line One, Dr. Woodard and his guest, Dr. Peter Friedman of the Brown University Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies, will discuss alcohol use and dependence. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, September 8th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 9 on FM 91.1 KSKA Anchorage. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. For my guests and all the people who made the show possible, thanks for listening. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.